This podcast is intended for investment professionals.
Mark, it seems like we've picked the perfect day for this. Protesters have been demonstrating all morning outside the London Stock Exchange as we're speaking here. Well, that adds a relevancy to the conversation, wouldn't you say?
Yes, it was ironic. I couldn't actually get into the building this morning to host our webinar because several climate change protesters had managed to glue themselves to the door. But fortunately, we were given access and we hosted the event, as you say, with Lord Stern. And I think he raised some very important points about both climate change and then indeed the wider opportunity for ESG integration. I mentioned during the webinar the remarks of the Swedish schoolgirl Greta Thunberg in her testimony to MPs this week, which was very powerful and I think very poignant. And the phrase, "You lied to us, you gave us false hope, you told us the future was something to look forward to." And I think one of the things that came through very clearly is climate change is a clear and present danger now, and we need to start doing something about it. Anyone who watched David Attenborough's documentary Climate Change, The Facts last week will have heard him talking about tipping points. Clearly, scientists don't yet know what those are and when they might occur, but the emphasis on those is that at that point, it may be irreversible, the damage that's been created. And so the message this morning from Lord Stern was that we need to do something. The science is very, very clear, and the risks are clear. I also cited some Bank of England statistics that show how inflation-adjusted losses, insurance losses from extreme events, have increased fivefold since the 1980s. So we all have an obligation, whether we are trustees of DB pension schemes or DC pension schemes, or indeed individual investors, to reflect these risks in our portfolio and to do whatever we can really to mitigate their effects.
It sounds like there's a real urgency right now, both in society and with investors alike, that we need to be dealing with it, and we need to be dealing with it within our portfolios as much as we need to deal with it as a society.
Absolutely. And also, we had Stuart O'Brien speaking, who's a partner at Sackers, and he was giving the legal perspective. And as many listeners will know, the law in the UK requires trustees of both DB and DB schemes by October to reflect ESG and in particular climate risk within their portfolio. And that is an important conversation, and many trustees are now having it around the boardroom table. But of course, where do you start? It's not an easy conversation. Do you reflect it in your, for example, DC default fund? Well, the answer is yes, you should do, because typically that's the vehicle through which many DC members achieve their pension obligations. The other question might be, do you reflect it in your equity portfolio, your fixed income portfolio? What if I have a property portfolio? And I think the industry is responding very rapidly to these. At one end of the spectrum, you have investors who simply exclude whole sections. But as Miriam Omi and Sonia Lord, our CIO and head of sustainability, said, that's quite a blunt tool.
Yeah.
And actually, there are now smarter ways to reflect these views in your portfolio, essentially using indices which tilt the portfolio away from certain sectors and towards those that we think will benefit from potentially the transition to a lower carbon economy.
A more nuanced integration approach.
Absolutely.
To ESG. Well, thank you so much. And now let's hear from Lord Stern, Chair of the Centre for Climate Change, Economics and Policy.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you to Legal & General Investment Management for drawing us together. I want to talk from the point of view of an economist, but I hope more broadly than that, about the urgency of action, the opportunities that lie within action, and how we accelerate action, because we're in a hurry. And I'll emphasize the finance side of accelerating action. Mark Carney has made this very clear to us in his speech just last month in Brussels on A New Horizon. He spoke of task is large, the window of opportunity is short, and the stakes are existential. We've heard from the IPCC in its 1.5 degree report just last year. We've heard from David Attenborough continuously, including very strongly last week. And we've heard over these last weeks and days from Extinction Rebellion and the protests that they've been making. They're right to emphasise the urgency of the story. We don't talk often enough about the opportunity. That is fundamental. And there's a tremendous set of ways of doing things out there, including cities where we can move and breathe, economies which are much more inclusive and attractive and which have sustainable growth within them. And finance, of course, is going to be fundamental to that acceleration. So this is what I want to talk about. First, urgency. Second, the opportunities in action, how you unlock it. And finally, the special role of finance. So what stakes are we playing for here? Well, just think of the difference between 1.5 and 2, which the IPCC report outlined last year. We're already at 1, that is, increase in average global surface temperature since the end of the 19th century, the usual benchmark. Now, just between 1.5 and 2, you see average drought lengths, for example, double. You see the frequency of rainfall extremes double. This is 1.5 to 2. We're headed for well over 3 degrees if we follow anything like business as usual, and even 3 degrees or more if we follow the Paris commitments. That shows just how much we have to move and accelerate. We haven't seen 3 degrees centigrade for around 3 million years, actually, when CO2 levels are roughly where they are now and sea levels were 10 to 20 meters higher than now. At this kind of change, hundreds of millions, perhaps billions, would have to move, with the consequence of severe and extended global conflict. These are the kinds of stakes we're playing for. Mark Carney was absolutely right to describe them as existential, as did, of course, David Attenborough. So what do we have to do? Well, we have to start reducing our emissions very quickly. We've got to accelerate, and we've got to accelerate quickly. That means turning down now and heading for net zero within 30 years or so for 1.5 degrees, within 50 years or so for 2 degrees. Net zero of fundamental importance, because all the time that emissions are positive, it means concentrations are rising and therefore temperatures are rising. So stabilizing temperature means net zero. The earlier we stabilize, the lower the temperature. This is what's been happening since the Second World War. We've had emissions going on rising around the world. An extraordinary acceleration from China in the first decade of this century. But we do see emissions plateauing. It's a plateau with some upticks, and the last couple of years we've seen upticks. So we have to get that moving down very quickly. And that, of course, means right across the world. Everybody is involved here. This is an immense risk, as we've argued, and the action must be urgent. Let me underline the urgency by speaking of three doublings. Infrastructure will double in 15 years or so. The world economy, just over 3% growth rate, will double in 20 years or so. The area of our world cities will double in 2 decades, and the population in probably less than 40 years. We have to cut our emissions very strongly in that time. For 2 degrees, by at least 20% in the next 10 years or so, at least 40% in these next 2 decades. So a doubling in 2 decades of the world economy, and an absolute cut in emissions by more than 40% in those 2 decades. If the new world economy, side by side with the old, had zero emissions, that wouldn't be good enough, because that would just hold emissions stable. So that's an illustration of how radical and strong that change has to be. But let me now underline how attractive that change could be. If we move quickly and strongly and build our sustainable infrastructure and our new economies in sustainable ways, we're going to have a boost in demand in a world economy that's still demand constrained, and a sharpening of supply. We're already unleashing a medium-term story of discovery, innovation, and investment and growth. You know all that as investors. You can see the kinds of progress we're making. We have momentum, but of course nowhere near fast enough. And let's remind ourselves that in the medium or long term, there is no high carbon route to growth that can last. It destroys itself on the hostile environment it creates. But we know that things are moving quickly. You can see, you know, that costs are falling very rapidly. I'm just illustrating here with solar modules and with observed battery prices. Those are still going on down, of course, beyond solar to wind and other renewables as well. So when I look back at the Stern Review a dozen years ago, who would have thought that the costs of solar and storage and wind would have gone down as fast as they did? Who would have thought that the main car makers, each one of them, each of the big car companies, would be talking about the end of the era of the internal combustion engine? That was 1 year before the iPhone. Who would have thought then of the Internet of Things and how we can manage our cities and our energy systems in a much more strong way? So we have this tremendous opportunity created by technical change on the back of, at best, mediocre policies. Imagine how fast we could go if we had strong policies. And please look at a piece of work called Mission Possible, published by the Energy Transition Commission just last autumn, showing that actually we can get, with very modest cost and with tremendous opportunities embedded in it, to zero emissions by mid-century. We have to move away from carbon-intensive activities as best we can, including by being much more resource efficient. We have to have much stronger energy efficiency right across the economy, right across the world, and we have to find zero carbon ways of doing it. But they go through in that Mission Possible report all this in great detail, great care. This really is possible and it really is attractive. Cities, of course, a very big part of this story. Roughly speaking, 3/4 of emissions and 3/4 of the world's output. It's what happens in cities above all that is going to decide our future. And we can make those cities so much more efficient and so much more attractive. Keep reminding yourself of cities where you can move and breathe, but also outside the cities and inside the cities of ecosystems which are robust and fruitful. That's what we can have as we work to reduce the immense risks, existential risks from climate change. So how do we unlock action? Well, we need policy right across the board. I don't have time to go into that in detail. Of course, we need carbon pricing and regulation around the emissions of carbon. That will be very important. We need more than that, of course. We need to invest in R&D. We need to invest in systems like grids and broadbands and recycling and so on. All of these involve public policy in some shape or form. And of course, we have to bear in mind the terrible costs, perhaps 9 million deaths a year around the world, of air pollution, which is associated in large part, not only, but in large part with the burning of fossil fuels. We need policies across all those sets of issues. And of course, we need policies that are clear and reliable. Government-induced policy risk is a huge deterrent to investment, and as we build those policies, we must make sure that those policies are clear and predictable. So that's the set of policies. I'd say lots of detail there that really matters, but I want to emphasize just one thing here, and that is the importance of managing change. We see reaction and resistance to good policy, partly because change has been managed so badly in the past. Now, we see a move from manufacturing to services as people's incomes rise. We see labour-saving technical progress. We see the international division of labour changing, globalisation. All these things matter to people's lives and they cause dislocation. We can manage that dislocation. We can offer new opportunities, lifelong learning, support for local skills, relocating public sector services, and of course safety nets. This is part of the story. It has to be a just transition, and there's so many opportunities in the transition to the zero carbon economy. It actually can be very helpful in managing those transitions. But public policies have to be just and to give everybody a chance. If we get it right, and these numbers are from the report by the New Climate Economy, which I co-chair with Paul Polman and Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, called Unlocking the Inclusive Growth Story of the 21st Century. We have much better employment. We have much less in the way of deaths from air pollution. And we have better public revenues. As someone who worked in a treasury for a while, that's a big story too, because you need the revenues to invest and to manage change. So there are real opportunities here if we get it right. Can it be done? Yes, it can. We've got very low interest rates. We've got rapid technological change. We've got the international agreements involved in the Paris COP20 up COP21 and the Sustainable Development Goals also of 2015. We have it in our hands. It needs involvement from everybody to make it happen, but the rewards are enormous. So what is the special role of finance in all this? And here, of course, we're starting. I mentioned the role of government, but of course the role of business and of finance is absolutely central to this story. Government can make it easier. Government can help create the conditions for investment, but there is still a very important role. Indeed, it's absolutely central. Arguably the key role is with the private sector and private finance. We've got to work, and this is what good policy does, to bring all these things together. Domestic public resources, that's of fundamental importance. And it was very good to see that in the World Bank IMF spring meetings, April the 13th, more than 20 finance ministers committed themselves to the Helsinki principles, which include aligning public policy to the Paris Agreement, carbon pricing, and so on. And that included the UK, France, Germany, and others. But as Mark Carney reminded us in his joint letter last week with the head of the Bank of France, we need to integrate climate change risk into everything, into firm management, into finance, into the public sector, into the central banks and so on. And we can see increasingly how to do that. It's wise risk management and it is strong encouragement and investment in a much better future. So what's been going on in the world? Well, you will know, and I don't have to develop this at any great length, the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, led by Mike Bloomberg, but instigated by the FSB at the request of Mark Carney. It's crucial to the why is because the risks are so intense. It must be sensible to invest in the technologies of the 21st century rather than the technologies of the 19th and 20th. Centuries. It's those old technologies that are the most risky. What do you have to do? Well, you have to look right across governance, strategy, risk management, metrics, and so on. And who? Well, everybody involved in the financial sector has to get involved. And it's building. There are lots of grounds of optimism, but every time I wax optimistic, you have to remind and put in brackets, indeed, drop the brackets, but not fast enough. But there's momentum there. There's something to build on. The Network for Greening the Financial System, that kicked off in the One Planet Summit, which President Macron of France called a year and a half or so ago, and now has 30 members involved, the Bank of France, People's Bank of China, Bank of England, the ECB, putting together sets of principles for central banks themselves, but also for the financial sector as a whole, of how to recognise risk, how to assess risk, how to build risk into what you do. The opportunities from doing things differently are immense. This is the growth story of the future. The growth story, the definite article, is important. The old high carbon story is not a growth story. It's the opposite. It's a destructive story. But it is one which is very exciting. Beyond the fundamental reduction of the immense risks from climate change. Old technologies are more risky than the newer ones. The world involves risk. That's the business that we're all in. That's the business that you're in. But the old technologies are the more risky, and we have to recognise that. Institutional investors can have a very big influence on government. They can go to government and say, if you get these policies right, there's a tremendous amount of money that can get behind them and do these really exciting innovations and investments that can drive growth. Clients are looking for it, and particularly the younger clients who are beginning their pension plans. They will want pension plans which involve investing in the technologies of the future for prudential reasons, but also because they believe it's the right thing to do. Companies which follow these follow much more responsible paths will get the best people. Unilever gets 2 million job applications a year. Companies that get the best people will do better. Companies which are responsible will see custom rise. This is a tremendous opportunity, and not surprisingly, the risk return profiles from this kind of responsibility are at least as good, arguably better, than being business as usual, which is essentially irresponsible.
I wondered if we could just touch on China for a moment.
Yes.
So I think that when President Trump pulled out of the Paris Agreement, one of the reasons he cited was that he didn't see China abandoning its own pollution emissions. Do you see that climate change and the pressures to do things differently is very much a Western story, or are you seeing progress in Asia as well?
Just to check one thing, President Trump announced his intention to withdraw from the Paris Agreement. The rules are such that they could not, the United States, withdraw from the Paris Agreement, given the notices that you have to give, until the day after the next presidential election. The observation about China was just wrong. I've been working in China for more than 30 years now. I'm involved in the advisory board of the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, and so I've been watching and trying to understand where China is going for a long time. China's is very committed to tackling climate change. Why? Because China has got deep water problems, and they depend on the ice and snow, the Himalayas, you know, for the Yangtze, the Yellow River, and so on. It's enormously important. They see China, the deep problems of air pollution, and they associate fossil fuel burning correctly with that. They see the technologies of the future, and indeed they're already pretty good at many of those technologies. So China sees this as essential to the future of China, and also with great opportunities for China. Their emissions are roughly plateauing. Their use of coal plateaued around 2014. It is not yet a downturn. There's some upticks. I hope that they are short term, but I hope also that during the 14th plan period, which is 2021 to 2025, that China's emissions will turn down. So I'm afraid that President Trump was somewhat ignorant of what's really happening.
And also, you mentioned in one of your slides the falling cost of clean tech energy. But yet Bill Gates has talked about the need for an energy miracle. Is it that we need something else to be developed, or that we need to do more with what we have today?
I think miracle is too strong. We need very strong progress, and surely if that's what Bill Gates means, he's right. And we need rapid progress beyond what we've seen already. But what we've seen already is quite remarkable. I mean, in many places around the world, renewable energy, solar or wind, plus storage, is already out-competing fossil fuels. Last year in India, which is of course very important in all this, they auctioned 40 gigawatts, and all of it, power supply, and all of it was won by renewables. I mean, it is remarkable how quickly that change is taking place. So if something that's already happening is a miracle, then let's call it a miracle. But I think I'd prefer to describe it as strong technical progress, much stronger than we anticipated, with much more there. But we have to invest very strongly in it, and we have to put in place the policies which will draw it through.
Mark, that was some powerful stuff from Lord Stern there, wouldn't you say?
Indeed. I thought the message was very clear. The issues facing us are significant. But he did end on a hopeful note. And I think he's encouraging all of us to take action and to accelerate that action, whether we are corporates or whether we're individuals, that we have this collective responsibility to do something and to do it now. Back in 2006, he talked about the prospects, a 75% chance, I think he said, of global temperatures reaching 2 to 3 degrees, temperature increases reaching 2 to 3 degrees. And subsequently then he said that perhaps he'd underestimated that. So there really is now every catalyst to respond.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and so would you say the key takeaway for investors is exactly that? There's a key catalyst, and here are the tools that can be employed to respond through investors' portfolios and assets.
Yes, and I mean, I liked the article I read that Stuart O'Brien from Saccas wrote last year, where he contrasted the difference between an ethical decision and an ESG decision. This isn't about ethics,
okay.
Whatever one's personal preferences or opinions might be. This is actually about financial risk. This is about a £20 trillion transition to a lower carbon economy, potentially, and the impact that that will have on investors, on their portfolios, and potentially the ability to meet long-term pension obligations. So ethics, obviously, very important to all investors, but the principle behind this is about financial risk and the ways that one might mitigate it, just as one mitigates, for example, inflation risk, or one tries to mitigate, for example, longevity risk. This is another material risk that trustees and pensioners should now be aware of.
And need to deal with. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Mark, and for leading such an interesting discussion with Lord Stern.
Thank you again.
If you'd like to view the whole panel webinar we held with Lord Stern and others, including Stuart O'Brien, Sonia Loud, and Miriam Omi, we've linked to the full recording in the episode's show notes. Thanks as always to our wonderful production team, and see you again next week for more Elgium Talks. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.